issues very early from departments about what they support and what they are not supporting and what they are doing. At least I think that's very helpful to prepare for. And I also want to welcome the Department of Public Works. The Department of Public Service. No, it's not a Department of Public Service and Commission. And then the National School of Government. Are you all here? Just for a short reminder, we have had a series of engagements with the department to hear them out on what they feel about the service, the current service here, and the extent to which they are affected, and what their objections are, and what their objections are, if any. Now, we then also decided that we would undertake a study tour to one of the countries that has a Foreign Service Act, or Foreign Affairs Act, whatever they call it. And that study tour has taken place last month. We were in Canada in September. We were in Canada for that kind of a study tour. When we came back, we then looked at the number of the departments that were outstanding. And to our surprise, we found that there were many departments that have not yet been consulted. And those, among those that were consulted, some departments said that they would come back. They would like to come back and make their resubmission. The Public Works is one of those departments. As you would remember, they are affected when it comes to the construction and the refurbishing and whatever happens to the buildings outside the country. So they've got their own suggestions. So it is in that context that we continue to meet departments. To the extent possible, it is the committee's considered wish that we should be done with all the departments somewhat close to the end of November. We will be meeting departments on Wednesdays and Fridays at our own discomfort, of course, because on Fridays members want to go into constituency work. They will stay on, at least for some Fridays, so that we should be able to enter into the class-by-class phase of the bill, and then from there it must go to the NCOP, from there it must come back. So it must go to the president for the president to assent. Our wish is that by 2019 the department, Ahmad, the president, should have been able to assent to this bill to make it an act of parliament. Now, and of course, maybe I should not include this one, but I might have to work South Africa. We have only the second semester next year. After June, many parties will begin to enter the phase of elections for 2019. So the program of parliament will become bumpy for parliament's work, obviously. So everything else must be done from June 2018. So with that, I'm welcoming you. Let me invite apologies for the record.
Thank you, Chair.
We have three apologies. One from Honorable Escalia, and she's at the Pan African Parliament. The second one is from Honorable S. Mokalaba, he is out of the country on political party business. And the other one is from Honorable Sweet Dudley, she's attending another committee. Thank you, Chair. Yes, sir. The last apology, Chair, is from the Public Service Commission. They will not be able to present today due to commitments. To other commitments, Chair. However, they are available for future, a future date. Thank you, Chair. Can we record the apology of the Deputy Minister, Gentleman Cronin? From your side, any apologies, officials? Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning. Good morning to honorable members as well. Apologies from our Director General in the Department of Public Works, who requested us to come on. And Advocate Sam Bugela. From the Department of Public Works.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to honorable members. I would like to send an apology on behalf of the Minister for Public Service and Administration, Ms. Faith Mutambi, who couldn't be with us today.
Yeah,
she tried to call me yesterday. Yeah. Perhaps let's quickly introduce ourselves, because you are not always with us. You are not Derko. Let's start with you. Who are you?
Good morning, Chair. Let us know Ramathagan is my name and a member of parliament. And I'm standing in for Tatum Pumlang.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Tatum Kenya, member of this committee of Canada. Thank you.
Good morning. Stan Mandla, the member of the committee.
Tumela, my name is Dineo Raputi. Thank you, member of this committee.
Good morning, my name is Peggy Fatele.
Lochane, my name is Sipo Sayazwe Masango, chairperson of this committee.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Honorable Chair. Honorable members of the Portfolio Committee on International Relations and Cooperation, and all the colleagues that are around. I'm Florence Rabada, and I'm the Acting Deputy Director General in the Department of Public Works, okay. And in the Policy Branch. Okay.
Good morning. Good morning, Honorable Member. My name is.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Joe Legala. I'm also from the Department of Public Works. I report to Florence Dagger.
Good morning, honorable members and of the chair. My name is Welcome Mukwena from the Department of Public Works. And we have seen
thank you.
Morning, Chair, honorable members. My name is Kasimo Lefe. I head the International Relations Unit in the Department of Public Works. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Victor Sakana, and I'm the Acting Deputy Director General from the Department of Public Service and Administration.
Good morning, honorable Chair and honorable members. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Zweli Momega. I'm the Chief Director of International Relations Corporation in the Department of Public Service and Administration. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members. My name is Tando. My surname is Wababa. I'm from the Office of Deputy Minister of Public Works. Thanks.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members. I'm Tanya Steenkamp. I'm from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor for International Law at DACAR.
Thank you very much. I have received a request from Honorable Maela that would like to leave early. So to the extent possible, we will try to, without going out the meat of the presentation, try to manage our time very well, so that we are able to reach one of the members who are under time pressure because of flight. Yes, and with that, let's hand over to you, madam.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Without further ado, Chairperson, emanating from the meeting that was held in Parliament just under a year ago, we were then requested at the Department of Public Works through the letter provided to the Minister in the previous week to come and present our written submission to the Portfolio Committee on International Relations and Cooperation on our representation on the Foreign Services Bill. And without further ado, I'm going to request my two colleagues, Mr. Peter Chapasco, to provide the background briefly so we get to the meat quickly, as Chairperson had indicated, and to provide us a quick background of the subject matter at hand today. And then following that, we will just take the members and all that are present in the meeting through the present written submission that we had prepared on the Foreign Services Bill. Peter, could you just...
Thank you, Florence. And once again, good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. My role is just to give context to the presentation that will be made. The context being that until May 1999, the Department of Public Works was the custodian of state-owned immovable assets abroad and managed that as it did the rest of its portfolio under its custodianship. At that point, the function was transferred to the Department of International Relations, but the disposal function remained within the department as a result of the State Land Disposal Act being the legislation that assists or facilitates the disposal of state-owned foreign assets. Subsequently to that, the Department of International Relations has sought to position itself to give effect to its mandate, which is the life cycle management of assets under its custodianship abroad, and has made proposals being the Section Chapter 8 in the Foreign Services Bill. The department has engaged with the Department of International Relations. I think as we presented at the last portfolio committee, we do not contest the custodianship. The custodianship was duly handed over, but the department would like to see it being done or executed in compliance with GIAMA as we know it, which is the Government Immovable Asset Management Act that the National Department put together, enacted as Act 19 of 2007. The objectives of that act being to provide a uniform immovable asset asset management framework to promote accountability and transparency within government, to ensure effective removable asset management within government, and the coordination of the use of removable assets, optimizing the cost of service delivery, very clearly articulated as the objectives of KIAMA. Our concern was that should the Department of International Relations and Cooperation wish to continue with the custodianship, which indeed they do, that they should do so under the auspices of KIAMA, that being the framework that has been set up for national departments. We duly made recommendations, and they have come back, and there's been dialogue between the two departments. I think I will hand over to my colleague, Mr. Lekala, now, who will then present as to how far we have come together in meeting of the minds in terms of ensuring the necessary alignment between the two departments.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Mr. Johannes Lekala will then take us through the purpose in the presentation, highlighting the issues for alignment, as Mr. Chapako had indicated, between the legislation on around the immovable asset management, safe immovable asset management, and the foreign services.
Thank you once more, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, honorable members, colleagues from other departments. I have loaded the presentation, it appears on the screen. The recommendations contained in this presentation, recommendations are at the very last slide, slide number 13. They start from 11, yes. The recommendations hinges on the contents of this presentation, which I will try to quickly go through. In terms of the purpose, the objective of this presentation is to briefly explain the nature and significance of the Government Removable Asset Management Act, which we generally call KIAMA, starting to contextualize section clause 8 of the Foreign Service Bill to KIAMA principles, reflect on possible unintended consequences, and recommend a remedial course of action. We draw our context from the Constitution. Section 2 of the Constitution provides the foundation by providing that it is the supreme law of the Republic, that law or conduct inconsistent with it is invalid, and obligations imposed by it must be fulfilled. Section 41(1) of the Constitution further provides that all spheres of government and all organs of state within each sphere must, amongst others, preserve the peace, national unity, and the indivisibility of the Republic. And that F, we specifically put also that it says they should not assume any power or function except those conferred on them in terms of the Constitution. The Constitution further provides in item 28(1) of Schedule 6 to the Constitution that on the production of a certificate by a competent authority that immovable property owned by the state is vested in a particular government in terms of Section 239 of the previous Constitution, a registrar of deeds must make such entries or endorsements in or any relevant register, title deed, or other documents to register that immovable property in the name of that government. It is now a requirement in terms of the Chief Register of Deeds, Circular Number 2 of 2013, issued on this matter that immovable property can only be registered in the name of the national or provincial government of the Republic of South Africa.
Chief Register Circular Number 2 of 2013 repeals Chief Regular Circular Number 9 of 2008, also dealing with the vesting of state immovable assets. Guillermo provides that as one of its objects that a uniform immovable asset management framework should be put in place to promote accountability and transparency within government. This object forms part of the long title of this act. Guillermo applies to departments of state in the national and provincial government. The act designates the Minister of Public Works as custodian to immovable assets that vest in the national government. The act further designates the Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform as custodian to immovable assets that vest in the national government situated within the former homelands and immovable assets acquired for land reform. And finally, designates a premier or an MEC designated by the premier in respect of an immovable asset that vests in a provincial government. An exception to that is where custodial functions were assigned to other ministers by virtue of legislation before the commencement of GIAM. And an instance is the one we are having before us in terms of the Foreign Service Bill, where custodial responsibilities were granted in 1999 by the former Minister of Public Service and Administration in terms of the Public Service Act to the Department of International Relations and Foreign Cooperation. Guillermo requires custodians and users to observe principles of immovable assets management in Section 5. Now, when DERCO was awarded custodial functions in terms of the Public Service Act, which was before Guillermo became law, when Guillermo became law, that meant that DERCO became one of the exceptions that is mentioned in Guillermo, where they were granted custodial functions. And one of the requirements is that they have to observe principles of immovable asset management in Guillermo, which principles are contained in Section 5. It is compulsory for a custodian to prepare a custodian immovable asset management plan and or a user to prepare user immovable asset management plan. These plans are regarded as part of a custodian and or a user's strategic planning process contemplated in the Public Service Regulations 2001. That is Section 6 of the Public Service Regulations requires government departments to present strategic planning documents. And this user asset management plans and custodian asset management plans are form part of those that process that must be complied with in terms of the regulation. A user immovable asset management plan is the principal immovable asset strategic planning instrument which guides and informs all immovable asset management decisions by the user. The custodian may dispose of a surplus immovable asset subject to the State Land Disposal Act 48 of 1961. Now, just to explain that, Government Immovable Asset Management Act specifically refers to the State Land Disposal Act and says that when a custodian disposes of surplus immovable assets, they have to comply with the State Land Disposal Act. Now, Guillermo, the management of immovable asset management act happens in terms of a life cycle of an immovable asset, which starts with acquisition and ends with disposal. So, disposal is the end of a life cycle of an immovable asset. And when you dispose, you have to comply with the State Land Disposal Act of 1961. The Department of Public Works is directly affected by Clause 8 of the Foreign Service Bill.
Clause 8 of the Foreign Service Bill, I'm not sure, Chairperson, if I have to go through the clause itself or I should skip that. Okay. Clause 8 of the bill provides as follows. Notwithstanding the provisions of the Government Immovable Asset Management Act or any other law, all immovable property utilized by the Foreign Service outside the Republic, any right in respect of such property and the management and accountability thereof must vest in the Minister. Yes. Notwithstanding clause 8.2, notwithstanding any other law, the minister may on such terms and conditions as he or she may deem fit, acquire and dispose of and lease, rent, maintain or construct structures or installations on or refurbish any movable property belonging to the department for the use of the South African missions or for any other purpose he or she may deem necessary for the efficient functioning of the foreign service. The misgivings expressed in respect of Clause 8 of the bill in the DPW presentation of the 25th of November 2016 are somewhat watered down by proposed amendments contained in DERCO's email of 1 September 2016. I will specifically refer to that email later. It is the Department's respectful view that the wording of Clause 8 should expressly recognize GIAMA as legislation applicable to national and provincial governments' immovable assets. This will obviate possible ambiguities, uncertainty, and unintended consequences in this proposed legislation. For instance, Clause 8.1 suggests that immovable property utilized by the Foreign Service must vest in the Minister. The vesting of property in the Minister's in the Minister is inimical to item 28.1 of Schedule 6 to the Constitution of the and the Chief Register Circular 2 of 2013 dealing with the registration of government immovable assets. GIAMA requires a custodian to comply with the State Land Disposal Act 48 of 1961 when disposing of surplus immovable assets. In essence, disposal forms part of the immovable asset lifecycle management, hence the requirement to comply with the State Land Disposal Act. I've already indicated that. The wording of Clause 8 in respect of the nature of the discretion granted to the Minister appears to oust the requirement to observe the principles of immovable asset management enshrined in Section 5 of the GIAMA. In terms of recommendations, the recommendation we are making is that a complete overhaul of Clause 8 of Foreign Service Bill is proposed, taking into account some of the suggestions already made by DERCO in order to bring the bill in line with GIAMA. The Department has, on previous discussions with DERCO, agreed to the following proposed changes being inserted in the bill. A, acquire, in respect of the word acquire, the definition of acquire. Acquire would read, in relation to an immovable asset, means acquisition through construction, purchase, lease, and acceptance of a gift outside the Republic for use by the Foreign Service. B, definition of immovable, insertion of a definition of immovable asset, which would read, means land or immovable structure on the land or right in such land or immovable structure. In relation to Clause 8 of the bill, the Department of Public Works proposed that the clause be worded as follows, or reworded as follows. Notwithstanding the provisions of Section 41A of GIAMA, the Minister is the custodian of immovable assets outside the Republic acquired for use by the Foreign Service. The Minister must exercise his or her custodianship in accordance with the provisions of GIAMA. Or it could read, the Minister must exercise his or her custodianship in accordance with Section 13.1 and 2 of GIAMA. And sub 3, the Minister must exercise his or her power to dispose of an immovable asset in accordance with the provisions of GIAMA.
We further propose that the definition of immovable asset be further strengthened in the following manner. Immovable asset means land or immovables. I have already, I think it's a repetition. In the end, Chair, I would just say that the proposed wording of the bill, I think, is not cast in stone. It could be subject to further discussions between the parties. This is just an illustration of how the provision could be reworked. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Department of Public Works. You know, when you used the word oust, you reminded me of someone among the departments who said that this bill seems to be annexing the functions or the mandates of other departments. Now you're saying oust. It's quite interesting. We've been joined by two honourable members who serve in our committee. Honourable Terra Likota is a member of the committee. No, the Terra doesn't suggest anything. He told me that he got his name when he was playing soccer. He was physically very agile at that time. That's what he said. He's a member of the committee, Terra Likota, and then Honourable Dudley is also a member of the committee, and I think there were officials on both sides. No? This is Public Works and Oderco, but also two officials from our side. Yeah, let's proceed at pace. I want to invite questions and comments from the members now regarding the presentation. Honourable Carter, is your hand up? Okay. Fire on.
Right, thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I'd like to welcome the presentation by the Department of Public Works. But what I'm interested in is those clauses, they say that they must be included in the section, the clause 8 of the bill. Those things which you refer to Kiyama. But I'm not sure what has like section 4.1a of the what does it say? Because if you are going to put it there, refer to it, what does it say in essence? Number two, and that one of the land, or section 13.1 and 2. I think that they must read it out, or they can give us the bill, the act in particular, so that we live with it. Ne? And then, but what I like, Chairperson, with this issue of Kiyama, is that there must be some sort of a plan of the acquisition of the assets and how they're going to use it. But right now, Chair, we dealt with the annual statement of Terco. They are buildings which are dilapidated, just like the former mission which was involved. Where was Kiyama in all that scenario? How will it help us moving forward? Yes. There was there were offices which were leased in Ghana, which are empty. Yes. Is there any penalties within Kiyama that if a department official does that, there must be consequences for that? Because sometimes if we're going to put Kiyama into this thing, but this fraud and these issues can happen when Kiyama is around. Well, what is going to be the reason of putting it in? Because already Kiyama was there in 2007. The decisions were done in the previous year, but did the department provide any plan around the users of this building? If the department does not do that, what are the consequences from the side of the air? Thank you.
Further comments on our Mayela?
Thank you, Chair, and maybe let me also welcome the presentation. It was very comprehensive. I would like to check because I can see the department is only focusing on two or three clauses, on clause 8 in particular. So maybe the take would be the department is comfortable with all the other clauses of of the bill. But I want to check one thing. Does the Department of Public Works have officials who are posted to foreign missions? And if they are you comfortable in the fact that even if those officials are the officials of Public Works, once they are posted abroad, they now report directly to Telco? Would they become the responsibility of Telco in terms of whether they are charged for misconduct or what? Am I clear? Okay. Sure. Thanks very much.
Hello, Kenya.
Thank you for the presentation. One of my questions has been asked, but what I'm going to ask is on the issue of you are concentrating on 8.1. Yes, I understand that you are saying that those property utilized must invest in the minister, with the minister. But I just want to check what are you saying about the 8.2? Are you comfortable about that sentence that talks to not repealing any other law the minister may on such terms and conditions as he or she may deem fit, acquire, dispose of, so all those A and B's under 8.2 A and B. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kenya. No any other members for now. Before your responses, was there anything between Public Works and the DERCO in the intervening period? Intervening period meaning the other time you presented to us and today. And if there was, I couldn't pick it up yet. I'm sorry about that. About how you've brought the meeting of mind, at least regarding disposal, acquisition, refurbishment, and that, leasing of the property outside the country or assets outside the country. Because we must just pick that up, that you are saying that in terms of Kiama, this responsibility can't and won't move away to any other department, to the extent that Kiama says it stays with the Minister of Public Works. And what did Jerko say about that? Or you are saying that that particular clause remains where it is, and that you think that this bill is annexing that mandate, and it can't unless you change the act. That's the first thing. But of course, the other one about workers. I would have thought that the department does not have workers unless it goes to, unless they go and perform a function like building, etc. If they are from Public Works or the company, something like that. And now, in the last presentation, I seem to remember, and I seem to remember that you did say what areas of the bill you are supporting, and what areas of the bill you found objectionable and why. I don't seem to have picked that up today. Just as a reminder that, no. Of course, I see you talking about clause 8. Just to say, we agree with the bill on this and this and this, but we don't on this and this and this. If that can be lifted up, it makes our work much more easier. Honorable Ramataka?
No, thank you, Honorable Chairman. It's just a small question. On the page 12 of the presentation, there's a proposal in terms of the recommendation, one that speaks about notwithstanding. I just want to find out from the department their presentation, because they citing Section 4 of Kiama, is the intention that you want that paragraph to be inserted in the clause 8 of the bill as drafted under the discussion now? And the reason, I just want to know why. Because if you read the current clause 8 as it stands, it's got a 1 and it's got a 2. And the 2 seems to cover your concern. Or do you say 2, that section 2, which is A and B, does not cover your section? I'm just asking that because it sounds a bit odd to suggest insertion of the existing law into a new law that has been made to address the gap. Because any act that is already on statute is applicable, and in terms of two, it will be applicable, your concern will be taken care of. So I'm just trying to understand the reason what is more worrying you to want to move this section that you want to insert. Did you not look at two? That's a clarity check.
Yeah, and I withdraw my earlier observation that I didn't hear you, what areas you are objecting on. My attention has been drawn to these recommendations by Honorable Kamakata, and I'll see where you stand. Now, Honorable Kota.
Sorry, I apologize, I came a little bit late. I just want to have some clarity with regard to 7.4 says that clause 8.1 suggests that immovable property utilized by the Foreign Service must vest in the minister. Is that the Minister of Public Works or the Minister of Foreign Affairs of International Relations? If so, from the point of view of maintenance, where does the budget reside? If it means the Minister of International Relations, what about the budget and the capacity to maintain and manage, you know, things like that? If not, if it means the Minister of Public Works, does Public Works provide or station capacity to maintain assets beyond the borders of South Africa? What is really there? How can you open that up for us to understand? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kota. Responses from the department.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Chapasco is going to respond on all the questions, except for the one as to whether the department has officials posted in foreign countries. Mr. Modefe is going to respond on that one. And then Mr. Lilaga and Welcome are going to assist us on the issues of drop 8, including the question posted by Honorable Legota on the budget and the capacity as to where it's placed and which minister are we referring to. So we will respond to the question in that order. Peter, you start, and then Percy will answer the other ones, and then Joe and Welcome will respond to the one on top 8. As to whether they not addressing what we are saying is our concern, as the honourable member is saying, so they will deal with that.
Chair and honourable members, thank you very much. Again, perhaps by way of context, until May 1999, the full function on the management of foreign properties resided with Public Works. We were the custodian, We planned for the maintenance, the construction, we were involved in the leasing. The Department of International Relations was the user department that would ask for that function of public works. But during the era of the ministers at the time, there were some discussions, and it was felt that because public works didn't have a representation abroad, the function was best executed by international relations. And in May 1999, through the Public Service Act process, the function was formally transferred to Foreign Affairs, as they were then known. It was Minister Swahir, the Minister of Public Service and Administration, etc. at the time. The only part of the function that was not transferred was the disposal function, because the State Land Disposal Act empowered the Minister of Public Works to execute the disposals. So since then, international relations has been planning, has been largely implementing, providing for funds, budgeting for funds, on a need basis. If they need architects or engineers or valuers, they will send a request through to the Department of Public Works, and we will go along with them to these places overseas, very much in support. One of the clauses of that handover was that they should not replicate the capacity within public works in international relations, otherwise you get two centers of expertise, right? So that's how we've been operating ever since. And we certainly like to support and be of value in terms of managing the foreign properties. However, the problem of disposals has been very much a problem. These properties have accumulated over time, and they need to be addressed as soon as possible. And I think this is one of the concerns of getting it legislated. When we came with Deputy Minister a year ago, we picked up that clause as it's worded, does not align with Kiama. And what is presented today is still very much that clause. What has happened subsequently, which addresses the Honourable Chairperson's concern, is that at the level of officials the two departments have met, we've made proposals on rewording. International Relations has sent counter proposals, which you do not see in the presentation today. I can read out where we are with it. There is still a small gap between that. It's again perhaps legislative drafting. The definitions have largely been accepted. So we're defining acquisition, we're defining Giamo, we're defining various elements. Some of these were presented before the House this morning. It's just minor gaps. And one of them, for instance, notwithstanding the provisions of 4.21 and 13B of Yama, the Minister, read International Relations, may dispose of assets under her custodianship in accordance with this Act, may. And it refers to this Act being the Foreign Services Bill, but in fact there's nothing in the Foreign Services Bill that talks to the way in which he or she would have to dispose that would need to be in accordance with the Act. It's left very open. And for that reason, the State Land Disposal Act is still there. And the State Land Disposal Act looks at many things, such as having to disclose to Parliament on disposals, acquisitive prescription in respect of deeds and reservation of mineral rights, and procedures in terms of documentation, such as title deeds and so on. So these issues that are covered by the State Land Disposal Act are not embodied in the Foreign Services Act. And in that regard, we as a department feel that it's still not sufficiently robust. It is possible, and it's a thinking, that the State Land Disposal Act could even be made applicable to international relations through a presidential proclamation where the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation might be given the authority to operate the State Land Disposal Act on the sector of custodianship that would be under her control. That would be a mechanism to ensure that the safeguarding and provisions would be would be provided for that. I think largely that gives context to the function before 1999, what has been happening with the function since 1999, and where we are in terms of the bill, where the proposed bill, where Section 8 as presented is the old one that we see today, but that the two departments have moved. It's just some fine-tuning that still needs to be done to get us to the point where we 100% at even with one another.
Further answer?
Thank you, Chair. I will further respond to two questions. One was posed by Honorable Ramatakani and another by Honorable Lukota. The question posed by Honorable Ramatakani relates basically to Clause 8.2 of the Foreign Service Bill. The question, if I understood it well, was he was trying to establish as to whether the provision as it stands does not really address our issues. But I think in the course of the presentation, we indicated the fact that we would like to see the clauses specifically referring to GIAMA, which is the framework that deals with government immovable assets. Now, the clause as it stands worries us in terms of, for instance, I think that's where in the presentation I referred to the ousting of the principles of GIAMA. Because if you look at the clause 8.2, it deals specifically with the discretion. It says the minister, the terms and conditions as he or she may deem fit. Now, if you look at the type of discretion, it's what one might characterize as an unbridled kind of a discretion, which does not conform to any requirement to account. And if you look at GIAMA requires, actually, one of its objectives is to promote accountability and transparency. It's stated expressly in the Act itself. So if we have a provision of this nature, in our view, it sort of ousts the applicability of the wholesome principles contained in GIAMA. So that is part of our concern, which we feel that is not really addressed in Clause 8.2. Now, in terms of the question that was posed by Honorable Lekota, if you look at GIAMA deals with the situation of a custodian and a user. So government departments are either custodians or users, or both a custodian and a user. Vesting of government immovable assets does not vest in a minister. It is a requirement of item 28.1 of the Constitution, in the schedule of the Constitution, and the Chief Registrar Circular of 2013, that when any property of government in the national government sphere is registered in the deeds office, it's registered in the name of the national government of the Republic of South Africa, provincial government of the Republic of South Africa, not a particular minister. I hope that answers the question.
And in this case, and in this instance, I'm sorry to just say, the national or provincial government of the Republic, in this instance, national represented by the capital.
Chair, if I may clarify that one. We have alluded to the fact that DERCO was granted custodial functions before GIAMA came into effect in terms of the Public Service Act. So
No. All I'm asking is whether, in terms of this circular by the Registrar of Deeds, is that
property outside the country can only be registered in the name of a provincial government or a national government. And in this instance, a national government is represented by Public Works. Now, after 2009, only custodial functions were given to DERCO. What was not given is the disposal, which, according to what you are saying, even in the office of the Registrar of Deeds, it is registered as belonging to national NS. National is public one. That's what I'm trying to establish. Or maybe I misunderstand, okay.
Perhaps if I may just get into to answer the question by the chairperson. National could either be, remember when we referred to the presentation, we said except where custodian functions would have been assigned to other ministers by virtue of legislation before the commencement of Guyana. Now it says national government of the Republic of South Africa, however there are departments and ministers who are custodians of properties at national level except the Minister of Public Works. For instance, the Minister of Land Affairs and Rural Development is the custodian of immovable assets for properties that are located outside the former TBVC state. And the Minister of Public Works would be the custodian of immovable assets that are resided within the former RSA. And there are also acts, that are providing that the Minister of Environmental Affairs and Water Affairs is also a custodian. So when you say national, it doesn't say which minister, it says national government. So when you read, it would never say public, it can either be public works or rural development or environmental affairs, because there was a legislation prior to Guyana that empowered the Minister of Environmental Affairs and Water Affairs, as well as the Department, the properties, the Defence Endowment properties, which are under the custodian of the Minister of Defence, because there was an act prior to Guyana, which provided, but then you would never find the registration saying Minister of Defence or Minister of Public Works or Minister of Rural Development or Minister of Environmental Affairs and Safety. Yeah. So that's how it is. But in this instance, it would be Minister of Public Works, in a sense that it was the Minister of Public Works that was the custodian of the properties that were they are being utilized by the former RSA, the former RSA. It would be the Minister of Public Works. In this instance, now that we're talking about the Foreign Service Bill, so it would talk about the Minister of Public Works. The custodianship.
Thank you, Chairperson. They didn't answer the question, Shari. One, dilapidated building. Right now, they acknowledged that they never gave the disposal function to foreign affairs of the Congo. So we have the problems of dilapidated buildings all over the world. And then it becomes a diplomatic nightmare when it is known that building belongs to South Africa, but that building is not maintained. It's precisely what Honorable Kota was raising. We are born in Namibia, Angola, and Brasilia. All those buildings, they are deliberate. Yeah, so who was supposed to have dealt with that? Because I think that part of having this bill in front of us is to improve the efficiency of government. Because in the sense, when you go to body, because when you speak about body, that's where the embassy of South Africa was before the unification of Germany. But they had to move from Bonn to Berlin, to Winterport. So that building was never maintained. It was not disposed of. So basically, it means that the country has lost. Because once, if it was sold during that time, we could have acquired the premium out of that property. So right now, as we're speaking, you said that thing was not, you've got a problem with clause 8. But that clause 8 also empowered DERCO to dispose proper Because when they no longer need it, must they wait for the Department of Public Works before they do that? Or, and then number two, Kiama came after 2007. There are certain things which it applies is a government work, it land management act. Were those principles not used in other departments? Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much. I saw that there was a young lady here, wanted to explain what TBVC stays where, because they are too young to understand it. Transkei, Botswana, Venda, and NC Sky. Now, if you were a clever sortie at that time, for instance, between Botswana and South Africa, the borderline was a street. So you just commit misuse this side. When the police are hot on your heels, you skip into this state that they can't arrest you in terms of law. It was interesting. I think you've been responded to and you are free to leave.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. I will go to my next meeting and release understand. The response that I have received is subject to a lot of discussion, and you will take that discussion forward. But this issue about ownership of asset, it's a big worrying question, because my rusty understanding is that that project, which was a custodian of public works, 5-10 years ago, would have resolved all that issue, that we don't necessarily have a reference to asset that belongs to the former TV state. That whole project register process, my understanding has been that that method has been solved. Then we would not have the problem of who is a custodian of property in the project, or property in this case. But that's public works issue, but let me be the chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable
Takana. We value your worthy contribution. Thank you very much. Are there any further responses so that we are done? Okay, over to you.
Sure, thanks very much. I'll do my best to answer the question in relation to the budgets as well. Since the fund has been with international relations, they act as both user and custodian. They will budget for this, get the allocation from National Treasury. They are supposed to ensure that they do apply to Kiama, notwithstanding the fact that Kiama came afterwards. It's still applicable to all departments. So all departments are required to have user asset plans, custodian asset plans, which are supported by funding programs, life cycle maintenance programs, and so on. To the extent that you have to hold an asset until it's disposed, you're still required to safeguard and maintain and secure that asset. With regards to the assets abroad, there are certainly interdepartmental discussions at the moment with regards to attending to that. The department has written to its counterparts at the highest levels with regards to exactly taking this matter forward. Mindful that there is another process with the legislation, do we wait until the legislation is approved, or can one already move on disposing on some of the surplus assets using the existing frameworks that are in place? So if international relations is satisfied and some are to be disposed, then can public works go ahead and dispose of them in conjunction with the other department? These are some of the discussions that are contemplated at the highest level so that they don't continue lying abroad vacant, incurring the problems that the honourable member has highlighted. So there are definitely moves afoot to deal with this matter outside
Chairperson. Just to summarize, I think the issue as per the presentation and the responses provided, as well as obviously the questions by the honourable members of the portfolio committee, I think the issue that the comment that the Department of Public Works is just raising before the committee is just the issue of just to ensure that should the Foreign Services Bill be passed into law, that we can all sleep well at night as the taxpayers of the country, as the ones that have been given the responsibility by the supreme law of the country, as well as other prescripts in the country, that these properties are well managed and they are safeguarded. And we ensure that through using taxpayers' money, by the way, whether internally or abroad. And to this effect, we still have, we still do not have a common mind with what we see on the bill. That should it go into it be passed into law, that I can sleep, or we can all sleep well at night, knowing that the properties will be safeguarded in the manner that we choose, and taking into account what they. All the legislation that we have placed before you and highlighted, and the clauses on the life cycle asset management will be taken care of. We still are not of the same mind, and that's where we are sitting at this point of time. It's just missing a whole lot of the how-to. It's like from where we're sitting, that you know, it's like we're still not of the same mind, even after the reiterative processes with the Department of International Relations, that we can sleep at night and say our properties are safeguarded properly through using taxpayers' money and so forth. So that's for the reasons that's specified in there. In the presentation and through the discussions that we've had. So that's basically our comment as we stand with the presentation.
So, but if you can factor in the elements of Kiyama,
if we factor in the elements of Kiyama and ensure that there's accountability and there, then we can sleep. Because then what it means is that if you give somebody a role to do, and yet you're not telling them this is how you're going to do it, and then they have like clauses such as the may being seen, you know, like using the words like may, and then the discretion, those discretionary words that are being used in the act like that. And then they need to be counted and they need to be very detailed, because if you look at the state Land Disposal Act, if you look at Kiyama, it's very clear on what needs to happen if we are to manage the properties of the state. Bearing in mind as well, I think the honourable member that has just left as well, to say that the ownership issue, I mean, is an issue that is to be taken and discussed further, that are we wanting as a country to now open up the issue of saying now everybody who's not satisfied with the services of another department, then we end up having too many custodians as a country that are safeguarding the immovable assets, rather than look at the mechanisms on how we can address the issues or not. So those are just the questions that are on the table from the Department of Public Works.
Chairperson, actually the last response of Mayor Rabata is troubling me a lot, because what has happened from the initial presentation, they said that there are a lot of things which have set up to the department. There are only minor things which are left. But I think that in that full regard, and then we don't have the privilege of the communication between themselves and the department, but then we are going to take decisions around that. If you don't have that here, will take the decisions which are going to make it to be seated. And then because right now, as I speak, that's why the original question I asked, at what are the punitive measures which Kiama has if the department does not comply? Because this issue of dilapidated buildings was there when Kiama was in place. What's the use of putting Kiama here? When things were falling apart, when Kiama was in place. Since 2007, Kiama has been in place. And these properties are continuing to remain delivered. But I understand now, the disposal function was left with the Department of Public Works. So if the DERCO, how can it continue maintaining a building which it does not use? Because it means that there's an opportunity cost for it. They have to provide the other services, just like economic diploma, whatever. They go and maintain a building which they don't use. And then they cannot dispose it because that function remains with another department. I think that even with Kiama in place, they have huge problems. So I think that really, Chair, we have to get that communication between the two departments so that we can be able to take that to the. But the issue of disposal, I still maintain, Chair, it must go to DERCO. But those check and balances they are raising, they are correct. If any property is disposed, it must be reported. Everyone must know, it must be a record of Parliament, whatever, that the former embassy of South Africa in Bonn was sold to whom for how much. That one must be on record. You cannot run away from that. But if these things are happening right now, when Jan is in the head. Thank you, Chief.
Well, following what the leader of that delegation from Public Works was saying, proper utilization of taxpayers' money regarding property, that we can all speak. I understood her to mean that they have the mandate and they have the capacity, you see, to build and to refurbish and whatever. Now, if you give this to someone whose principal function is not constructing buildings and refurbishing them, where do they get the capacity? In a department like this, the principal function is to have the diplomats and the relations and other. Now, more ad alone, only outside the territory. I think the concern seems to be have come from there. But how they create your capacity of disposal, your build, I wonder. But only if it is outside. You enter South Africa and then the public will become responsible. Then I see a line of argument there. However, the content advisor brought to my attention a communique that was sent. Was it sent to Minister of Foreign Affairs? Minister by Square, and whether this is still binding. You see, what it says is that after considering your letter dated 12 October 1998, and of course, why in October now, in the above regard, the above regard is placement of the function concerning the management and procurement of properties and accommodation abroad. After considering all the facts at my disposal and in the interest of the state, I have decided on recommendation by the Public Service Commission in terms of Section 3.3A of the Public Service Act 1994 that the function to manage and procure properties and accommodation abroad, including all aspects regarding leasing, purchasing, disposal, alteration, maintenance, refurbishment, furniture and facilities, be allocated to the Department of Foreign Affairs with effect from May 1, 1999. So disposal is we will bring this letter to have given them a copy. So the argument is that
disposal is one of the functions that was. Yes, can we hear you?
Chair, just to clarify the point around that, I think in my presentation I covered that point. I mentioned the fact that, and that letter is before Giyama came into operation. And in my presentation, I mentioned the fact that it's that kind of a scenario is one of the exceptions through which custodian functions can be handed to another department. And what does custodianship mean? Custodianship means the management of immovable assets. And management of immovable assets means acquisition and all the other aspects to disposal. Now, the point we are making here is about the framework which became law in 2007, which creates a uniform way of managing movable assets so that there can be accountability and transparency. And specifically, in this uniform framework, in this 2007 law, it is mentioned at section 13.3, that a custodian may dispose of a surplus movable asset, and I'm going to read sub B thereof, subject to the State Land Disposal Act and any provincial land administration law by the sale, lease, exchange, or donation of that movable asset, and so on. Now, our interpretation is that even if all the aspects of immovable assets, which include disposal, were granted to another custodian, that custodian must comply with this framework. And this framework includes the State Land Disposal Act, which they must comply with. I think that's the point we're making, Chair.
Thank you. Kulme out of record.
Okay. Thank you very much.
It is agenda much. So now it's the input by Public Service and the National School of Government. Yeah, number five, who's leading? Bob, over to you. You can stay on, it's not a problem. Bob.
Can you get your name again?
Thank you very much. My name is Victor Sakala.
Sakala.
Not Sankara.
I am Bob Sankara, Sankara of the president. Over to you, Baba.
Thank you very much, and good morning once more again to honorable members and colleagues. As I've indicated, my name is Victor Sakala from the Department of Public Service and Administration, and I'm the Acting Deputy Director General for Employment Conditions of Service in the Department. Chair, flowing from the meeting of the Portfolio Committee on International Relations and Cooperation on the Foreign Services Bill, and the subsequent recent submission that was made, indeed officials from the Department of Public Service and Administration and officials from the Department of International Relations met to deal with the issues that were raised as concerns in relation to the Foreign Services Bill, which in the main created concurrent powers for the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, as those powers are in actual fact vested with the Minister for Public Service and Administration. I have prepared a presentation just to take the portfolio committee members through. I'm not sure if this is going to be clear.
Which one?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, Dr. Wanda. Okay, thanks. The presentation will basically deal with the issues that were identified flowing from the written submission. The first issue that we'll be dealing with is in relation to the definition of foreign services as envisaged in the Foreign Services Bill vis-a-vis the employee in terms of the Public Service Act, the appointment requirements to the foreign services vis-a-vis what is contained in terms of the Public Service Act, the challenges with the concurrent powers between the Minister for Public Service and Administration and the Minister for International Relations and Cooperation to make determinations on specific employment matters, and also flowing from that, the concerns that was raised by organized labor in the collective bargaining space. Now, Chair, in terms of the Public Service Act, an employee is defined as a person appointed either permanently or temporarily, part-time or full-time, in a post-establishment of a department or additional to the establishment of a department. The Foreign Services Bill, according to Section 2 of the bill, comprises of all South African missions and of those persons who serve in positions in South African missions and who are accredited to a foreign state for the period of time that they hold that position, regardless of whether they are ordinarily employed by the department or by any other national department or appointed on a contractual basis for a fixed period. Therefore, the Foreign Services includes employees appointed in terms of the Public Service Act. Such employees in the Foreign Services are therefore bound by the provisions of the bill and the Public Service Act. Now, due to the application of both the Public Service Act and the bill on certain employees within the Foreign Services, the following challenges therefore arise. In terms of Section 3, one of the Foreign Services Bill provides that only citizens of the Republic employed by the Department of International Relations or by any other department who meets the prescribed requirements are eligible to become members of the Foreign Services. And I think that becomes a problem, because in terms of Section 10 of the Public Service Act, it provides that persons who are citizens or permanent residents may be appointed in the public service. The provision of the bill is therefore inconsistent with the Public Service Act. Now, Section 9 of the Public Service Act provides that the Minister for Public Service and Administration prescribes the manner and conditions under which persons are appointed in the public service. This therefore means that the employees appointed to foreign services will have two pieces of legislation to comply with. Secondly, it would appear that both the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation and the Minister for Public Service and Administration exercise similar power of powers which have the potential to conflict. Now, in terms of the powers of the Minister for International Relations, Section 9 of the Foreign Services Bill provides that subject to any collective agreement applicable to the foreign services, the minister, and in this instance being the Minister for International Relations and Cooperation, may make any policy, code, or prescribe any ancillary or incidental administrative or procedural matter that is necessary to prescribe for the proper administration and management of the foreign services and its members, which is consistent with the Act, provided that the determination involving expenditure from revenue shall be made in consultation with the Minister of Finance. The Minister may further issue directives which are consistent with the Act to elucidate or supplement any regulation. The Minister or Director General, as the case may make all decisions relevant to the management and administration of the foreign services after consultation with any other relevant national department. Section 12 of the Foreign Services Bill provides that the Minister may make regulations regarding, amongst others, the transfer of a member of the Foreign Services, conditions of service applicable to members of the Foreign Services, disciplinary matters, adjustment of allowances of members of the Foreign Services, transfer to South African missions, and secondment of an employee of the service of a foreign state. Now, with regard to that, then these are the powers in terms of what the NPSA is conferred with. Section 22A of the Public Service Act provides that subject to the Labour Relations Act and any collective agreement, the determination of any condition of service of employees in general or a particular category in terms of this Act shall be made with the concurrence of a committee of ministers. The conditions of service for the purpose of Section 22A means annual salary adjustments, salary scales or levels, performance bonuses, pay incentives or pension benefits. Section 33 of the Public Service Act allows the Minister for Public Service and Administration, through regulations or determinations and directives, to determine norms and standards on, amongst others, conditions of service, employment practices and labour relations. Section 35 of the Public Service Act provides that subject to the Labour Relations Act and any collective agreement, the MPSA may make determinations regarding any conditions of service of employees generally or category of employees, including determinations regarding a salary scale for all employees or salary scales of particular categories of employees and allowances for particular categories of employees. Now, based on our analysis of the two pieces of legislation, currently the conditions of service and allowances payable to employees in the public service, including employees who make up part of the envisaged foreign services, are subject to collective bargaining processes and determined by the Minister of Public Service and Administration in terms of the Public Service Act. Now, Section 9 and 12 of the Foreign Services Bill appropriate similar powers to the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation as those currently vesting within the MPSA. This could therefore result in two conflicting determinations arising in regard to similar matters, each taking effect under different legislation. Now, Section 7 of the Foreign Services Bill seeks to provide for the establishment of consultative coordination and other mechanisms, and is cognizant of the Intergovernmental Relations Framework Act of 2005 to deal with conflicts that may arise. There is no indication as to whether the provisions of the Public Service Act or the bill will ultimately take precedence. It is our view that legislation should not create concurrent powers that requires to be dealt with through the dispute mechanisms under the Intergovernmental Relations Framework Act. It is therefore proposed that the bill itself should provide clarity on this matter. Now, Chair, currently the Foreign Services Dispensation is pursuant to the collective bargaining processes issued as a determination under the Public Service Act by the Minister for Public Service and Administration. As the bill does not repeal this power, the challenge in its implementation is envisaged. To ease labor tension, the bill was tabled in a special workshop at the Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Council on the 2nd of December 2016. Labor raised the following issues: that the definition of foreign services and how it changes when the incumbent returns to South Africa, whether heads of missions who are appointed for a period of 4 years or more from outside are members of the foreign services. There is no mention of gender parity in the bill. It is important as South Africa that it is expressly stated. Clarity is sought on whether heads of missions have oversight responsibility or more authority over reports, whether they are responsible for the management of personnel matters and or operational matters over employees posted by the department or other than DERCO. And I think this is an issue that was raised by the Honourable Member. Will the performance management and development system continue for employees in a foreign country? Section 9 of the bill provides for the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation having sole responsibility. Will this affect further negotiations within the Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Council, which is the sole responsibility of the Minister for Public Service and Administration? Now, Section 12(1A) of the bill appears to give the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation power to issue regulations on, amongst others, conditions of service of foreign services employees. The section does not make any reference to labor relations or collective bargaining processes. Labor has expressed a desire to further engage on Section 12 in totality of the bill as it impacts on their members. It would appear that the foreign services will create a separate sector within the public service comprising of the foreign services with no indication of how collective bargaining will be conducted or what dispute resolution mechanisms are to be used for the foreign services bill. It should be noted that the Department of International Relations and Cooperation requested the DPSA to retable the bill at the PSCBC for further engagement. And unfortunately at this stage, when we are ready to present the bill, they have requested that they must be given enough time to deal with certain issues that have been raised by the department. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah. Some of the issues we are raising were raised by labor. This last part arising from the PSPC meeting. Members, can I hear you? Any clarification questions? Any comments? Or Kono, is there anyone who wants to add? In addition, members? On our own, please.
Yes, sir. I mean, for the fact that even the Department of International Relations has owned up to say that they must be given more time, it is really true that, you know, the issues of bargaining, the issue of all the issues that have been raised here, they are true, Chairperson.
So time really to work on this bit, it is of importance. I fully agree with the analysis, the critique of and the recommendation that you came with. I think in that.
Thank you, Honorable Rafuti. Does not have pages. But let's name that page 3. Where you're talking about requirements for appointment. We are saying that section 3.1 of the Foreign Service Bill provides that only citizens and it's analyzed, Mr. Sakar. Only citizens of the Republic can be employed by this department if they meet the prescribed requirements. And then we are then saying Section 10 of the Public Service Act provides that persons, it doesn't say only citizens, who are citizens or permanent residents may be appointed to the public service. The provision of the bill is therefore inconsistent with the Public Service Act. Now, you know what I'm trying to understand? Yeah. If you say the bill is inconsistent, it's because I thought that the Public Service Act provides for persons who are citizens of South Africa, some of whom may have got naturalized citizenship or work permits, things like that. Now, people like that can be appointed to work in the public service of South Africa. But that the bill is referring to people who are going to work outside the country. Meaning that it deliberately, the way I read it, deliberately wants to exclude a Zimbabwean or a Nigerian who is now a South African citizen, you see, from being appointed to represent South Africa, because when you are representing a country, amongst others, you are representing the national interests of that country in another country. Now, you know, it reminds me the matter about the coaches. Yeah, it could be that the issue about the coaches, that you hire a coach from Peru, and then the next thing, the national team must play against the national team of Peru, and the coach comes from Peru, and this person has got a work permit in South Africa and has not relinquished his or her citizenship of Peru, when he or she goes back home, he's got to account why one day he made you know, the national squad to be vanquished by, you know, the country where he was working. But maybe the example is not suitable. So I was just trying to understand it that way, that perhaps they are deliberately trying to exclude someone who may not be a citizen of South Africa, so that at least at this level you are represented by someone who is a natural citizen of the country. But for purposes of employment, employ anyone who is now here in South Africa. That was my
Now that was my clarification question. Honorable Lukota wants to come back. Honorable Lukota.
Looking at this presentation, the first point that arises here is that there's need to of realignment, of making certain two departments have got power, same powers, or two ministers have got powers on the same issue. And that is, means we need realignment there. We must determine that one and not both, because you continuously have this conflict where one will want the other, one thing one wants the other. This power needs to be located in one place, first and foremost. Once that is done, and I don't know whether there's a proposal here, I thought I was going to get a proposal as to who is being recommended to do that. It can't be, well, in my view, it ought to be, can't be international relations. The Minister of International Relations is all over the world, and she'll be employing Eskimos and whatnot, and then far from here. So we need somebody that's located home-based, so that the standards and all of that are done here. Once you're employed here, you can be sent to where you are going to do that. So we need to look at that recommendation. As this page, this paper is not paginated, we need some help with regard to that. Then the second thing is that national legislation must inform the policy positions that whoever is designated as the employing ministry must follow. And those two processes are the ones that we really need to tackle. Now, with regard to what you were saying, Chair, as long as there is peace in the world, you can employ anybody from anywhere. As long as there is peace between your country and other countries, you can employ anybody. But as soon as conflict arises between your nation and some other nation, and world history has ebbs and flows, once there is tension, the reason that there are such crimes as treason and things like that arise in those circumstances in which, in a conflict, survival of citizens or survival of one nation against the other becomes a very, very critical and serious matter. You can see that even at the present time, if you look into the situation of our country, with all this corruption and in which foreigners come into the country and are implicated in activities that undermine the welfare of the people of the country, that you have now to reflect whether it is wise to have certain people from certain countries playing a role in critical positions of government when citizens of this country are suffering. So soccer is not such a serious matter, perhaps, although once upon a time two Latin American nations went to war over a soccer match, actually, mobilized armed forces, the borders of the countries, and fought. So that is very, very rare. But these issues of survival are really serious matters. In the drafting of legislation or recommendation of legislation, it's important that our experts take into account the ebbs and flows of international, continental, regional movement of history and so on, because you make law not only for today, to recommend law for conditions of peace and for conditions which are not of peace, for conditions which are favorable and conditions which are not favorable. So we have to say that we carry this responsibility. And so we do need recommendations that will enable us to leave a legacy of legislative pieces that will forever and continuously protect and preserve the welfare of our people in the future for generations to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Kwata. I apologize, I omitted to introduce and welcome Honorable Nyamezeli Boy, one of our senior members of parliament over a period of time. Welcome, Honorable. And you are free to ask questions and make comments. Honorable Kateri?
No, thank you, Chairperson. In the previous presentation of the budget of public service and association, I was not in here when they made the presentation. But I thought that they should have understood by now that here with this bill, a new cadre of the public service is being developed. Apart from that, it's true, when coming to the issue of the definition of the employee, the Public Service Land Act says even the permanent resident of the country. But when coming to the issue of the foreign service, it's different. Take, for example, the head of mission in the country represents the president of the republic. It's far different. Take, for example, a director general of a department can be appointed because of his skills, whatever it might be. But when coming to the head of mission, he represents the head of state, that is the president. So will someone who's coming from America, who's an American citizen, who's now a permanent resident of South Africa, represent South Africa in China? Yes. Making an example, represent a permanent resident of South Africa who comes from America, can he go and represent South Africa as an ambassador in China? We're knowing very well that there's hostility between China and America. So I think the Department of Public Service must be able to see that there are certain exclusions which must be made. And these exclusions can only be made through an act of parliament. We need to see that we do need that. When you go to number C, the issue of the labor matters, you are referring to the fact that those guys will have to comply with the two different legislations. But already it is happening now. The police service, those people are public servants, but there are certain things which are excluding them from, take example, just like the police. The police cannot go into a strike. Because although they are public servants, but there are certain exclusive conditions which they have to operate under. The defense force, the intelligence services, there are certain exclusive conditions in which they have to comply. So it is not the high time that we have certain categories or exclusions for the foreign service as it is. Or, Chair, with the issue of putting the trumping clause, indicating in this bill that when these two acts are in conflict, which one is going to take precedence? I think we can rectify that by putting that into the act, Chair. And then on the other issue, as you correctly said, that one thing which is happening now in our foreign service is that the various departments are operating in a fragmented way. We were in Canada with this thing. In Canada, this Act of Canada is very clear that whatever department has seconded a person to a mission, the head of mission is the one who's going to supervise. That is, it means that person, that diplomat, he can be a military attaché, he can be an intelligence officer. Whatever report he's going to send to the Canada department cannot be done without the head of mission knowing what is happening. So I think those are the things which we must put the issue, because I see that they've got an issue of the oversight of the other land or public service from the other department. But already in the law of Canada, it's very clear. They were very clear that once the head of mission, everyone who's there has to account to that. Do they have a problem with that as a public service and understanding?
Responses from the team?
Thank you very much, Chair. On the issue that both the Chairperson and Honorable Hartley have raised in relation to South African citizens, I think what we are basing our argument on is based on a constitutional court ruling that indicated that permanent residents enjoy the same hiring rights as South African citizens. And that is why that the proposal that was made to say that it cannot be exclusively South African citizens or only. But we are also mindful that, that there are processes that have been placed now or put in place in relation to the bill itself, in relation to the vetting of those who would be appointed. And I think those then those processes would then assist in making sure that it sifts out those, if I may put it, those who may not be desirable to be placed in missions to represent the country. Now, the issues that indeed were raised by Honorable Lukota in terms of the alignment of the bills and the Public Service Act, that is basically what we are envisaging. And that is what we have indicated in our proposal with the department. Unfortunately, the department was supposed to come back to us, but based on what Labour has requested, that the meeting where they could make better input was supposed to take place on the 12th of September 2017. Unfortunately, due to the request that the department be given further time, then they couldn't even respond to the questions that we had raised so that there can be alignment in terms of some issues that we had raised and concerns around the bill itself. Indeed, Honorable Hadebe, the issue that you have indicated with a new cadre being introduced, it is acceptable. The biggest challenge is that, as you alluded to, the public service or the police service are appointed in terms of two separate legislations. There are those who are appointed in terms of the Public Service Act, and there are those who are appointed in terms of the Police Service Act. Though both of them are regarded as public servants, but they are managed in terms of the two different legislations. So therefore, that is why you'd find that in a recent situation that has happened, which was in the news, where you see that the 10111 staff, they are appointed in terms of the Public Service Act. Therefore, that is why they could go on strike. But the police, because they are appointed in terms of the Police Act, they couldn't go on strike because they are classified as an essential service. So indeed, we acknowledge that, but we are also mindful that there are different pieces of legislation that can be implemented. I think as I've indicated, from our side, we are just waiting for DELCO to give us their input in terms of what we have made, and unfortunately, we couldn't have the time to do that. But that is part and parcel of the proposals that we have made. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Yes, if you, I think the clause that talks to contradicting legislation, which one should supersede, I think it's a very good idea that needs to be looked at. And I think we note that, and we shall take it back to the department, and we shall engage them on that matter. Thank you.
In the absence of further comments, we will then invite the last presentation from the School of Leonore Nisling, madam. Okay. So these are just to tie up the presentation. So these are the areas in which you have some objections as
the Department of Public Service and Administration. And I see that you have factored in issues that were raised in the PSPC. And when they met us, they raised some of these matters. And they did say that some of these matters that are contained in the bill are matters that may make them go to the street if they are just implemented as they are. We will see whether after all consultations we will go back to them and see whether there's a meeting of minds between them and the department, or that they still stand where they were standing at that time and date. So that we bring it to the attention of the department, so that here are the sticky issues that seem not to have been resolved. And as I've indicated, fortunately, Mrs. Pierkamp from Derko is always attending these meetings, and she's taking note of who says what and who says what. I think by the end of all presentations, all departments, she will be able to engage her team in the department according to clauses and what people have said. And that will also assist in the evolution of the development of this bill. And with that, thank you very much for your presentation, and send our regards to the minister. We did receive an apology from the minister. Thank you very much. Once again, let's now welcome the last presentation. It's called NSG Response to Foreign Terrorist Bill. Is it this one? Okay. And you are Mrs. Leo, how is it pronounced? Leonor. Nefeng, over to you.
Good morning, honorable members, and thank you for the opportunity to share our responses with you today. Basically, our presentation is built from our experience that we've picked up doing disability management training in the public service. We noticed that social development, I'm not sure if they were involved to give input, because they are also looking at disability management, but we did it from a training perspective. Okay. So, basically, the background, as I said, is we've got courses in disability management, which are helping to implement the conventions and the white paper on the rights of persons with disabilities in government. And through our training, it has enabled us to determine that still there's a lot of work to be done to promote the rights of persons with disabilities in all spheres of government. And we get that from, as I said, the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which we are signatory to, as well as the White Paper on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which was signed and effected in December 2015. Now, Pillar 1 of the White Paper on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities argues for the removal of barriers to access and participation, which is being experienced currently with persons living with disabilities. And it says that we must remove and provide access, and we must look at things like universal design for persons with disabilities. So what we've picked up, because I've trained senior managers from Durka myself, I'm responsible for HRMND training in the National School of Government. I've trained persons from Durka, and I've gotten a sense of their working environment. So the mainstreaming approach and reasonable accommodation should be in all programs, policies, procedures, infrastructure. So, for example, in our missions, our South African missions, we need to ensure that it's enabling persons with disabilities. We need to prioritize budgets, the departmental budget, mainstreaming disability issues that we are able to provide reasonable accommodation support and disabled specific services and assistive devices. the budgets need to start including that. So when you go on a strat plan, the department needs to start planning that. And we would like the board to start just reflecting a little bit around this, to be able to have all the different pieces of legislation and white papers start talking to each other, because we found that there's a lot of fragmentation in terms of goals and acts, and there's no integration and linking up, and that's our perspective where we're trying to come from in terms of this book. So the second article, 27 of the United Nations Convention, is focusing on work and employment, and that advocates for the rights of persons with disabilities to work on an equal basis with others and have effective access to general technical and vocational guidance programs, placement services, and vocational and continual training. So the second focus for us, apart from reasonable accommodation and looking at infrastructure and buildings, is to look at the training. Because persons with disabilities actually have the right to gain access to information. They have a right to gain access to information in a format that will be usable to them. So what we'd like to propose, and this is on slide 3, if you don't take the cover sheet into account, that's slide 3. Section 9 deals with policies and codes and procedures. So the place where I thought we could add something around the disability issues is in line with this section. So I tried to word it in such a way to say that the Minister or Director General, as the case may direct or allow for reasonable accommodation and the promotion of the rights of persons with disabilities who are recruited to serve at a South African mission, which would mean, according to the bill, people can be local and they can be recruited to serve in the mission. All who serve as members of the Foreign Affairs Service in accordance with the convention and the white paper that I've just mentioned. So this directive may be included then in terms of reasonable accommodation and an access and universal design in all codes to be called the Foreign Affairs Service Administration Manual, the Code of Conduct for the Foreign Affairs Service, or any other code that may be adopted. So what we are saying is we want to see that, like the gender issues that was mentioned by the DPSA, the disabilities may be streamed into any and all codes which Foreign Affairs or the DERCO will be putting out there. And then the next proposed addition is around capacity building and training. So in section 6 of the bill, under 6.1a, we just want to make an addition to some of the wording. So it reads, the Diplomatic Academy, under the control and management of the department, is responsible for A, providing training or causing training to be provided to employees and to members of the Foreign Service. And then we would like to add, in a format or means that will enable persons with disabilities to readily access learning. So that's basically our presentation, and that's what we wanted to add to the bill. Thank you so much.
So the main weakness of the bill is that it does not have this kind of provisions regarding persons with disabilities.
Yeah, what I picked up in terms of training various departments and on all sectors of government is that people potentially see, yes, we have to have a certain percentage of persons with disabilities appointed, but then what? You know, they have to be provided a reasonable accommodation. And unless we start maybe writing it into the procedures and processes and the board, just as a reminder that we need to do that. Otherwise, it doesn't just happen. It's not ticking the boxes to say, yes, it's appointed and we've reached the percentage. When the president says I'm concerned, it means I'm actually very worried because we're not doing this for. So that's what we're recommending.
Yeah, over to the member. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Member?
Thank you, Chairperson.
thank you, Chairperson. I don't know whether the National School of Government did write to the department about this issue. Did you interact with the department around this issue?
No, honourable member. We actually just received the bill on Wednesday night, and I got hold of it around 11 o'clock yesterday. And we are today.
All right, Chairperson, I think that, that input, I think, is very important, yeah? Because the people with disability are really, they portrayed like any other person in the country. In fact, one of our ambassadors is disabled, and he's one of the best. He is one of the best, yeah? But I think that this issue of proactive training and providing the proper facilities for that is the correct thing. I don't see any problem about that, yeah? But what I would have thought they'll come with is what the Labour Nehau raised previously. Because Nehau was opposed to the creation of the Diplomatic Academy. Mm. They said that the School of Government is adequate for that. What is your take around that? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr.
Khatel.
Mr. Reporter. Noted, Mr.
I was going to ask, and I really ask, honestly, out of curiosity, what is the percentage of disabled persons in our nation? What is the percentage? I'm sure if you ask what is the percentage, you'll be able to tell us. What is the percentage of among the people of South Africa? But can we say what is the percentage of the disabled persons in our society? And therefore, whatever determinations we are going to make are guided by this information. And then we talk about employment of disabled people and percentage in that. What percentage of the disabled people is there in the universities, technical colleges, and all of that? Do we have that percentage being trained so that it can feed into the percentages that we say we are requiring at employment level? There's no point acquiring a certain percentage when the disabled and all of that are unemployable. We must first make them employable before we can then say we want that percentage. Do we have that percentage trained and therefore available? Because we can put these percentages there, but if we have not prepared these people for employment, we will find that we'll advertise and advertise, but nothing will happen because it's not happening there. And then, of course, there has to be some kind of interaction between the Department of Education and the other departments. What collective interdepartmental programs are being run to ensure that we are making linkages that will produce the desired percentage. Now, I completely support the idea that we should ensure that every section of the population must be made to be able to sustain itself. And yet we can't do that unless we transform our population to be carriers and agents of that transformation. And it must start at education. You know, it must start at the Afrikaners. Whatever else we say about the Kruger Bond, one of the things that they did when they had not worried about the poor white problem, they took every child from the countryside, from orphanages and all of that. They put the academically inclined, as they identify them, into this, and then the more, you know, the ones that are talented into technical things and so on. Once they had made them like that, a process that they put in place was that by making them employable, they closed the road to poverty. Because these people, each one of these people, could go and get employment and earn their income. And then the hobos disappeared from the streets of our nation. We need to, this is something we need to understand. We're not going to terminate backwardness and poverty and inability of the unemployed and of the disabled and so on, unless we transform South Africans of all races into people that are able to earn for themselves and therefore become agents of transformation of their own conditions of life. So we can start with this disability thing. We just say we are going to make sure that all of the disabled people or people living with disability, all of them, must be trained in one way or the other. Some of them can be very talented speakers and excellent teachers, lecturers, whatnot, because most of them is physical disability. It's not disability to speak. And there's nothing wrong with the intellectual comprehension. So they can do anything and everything. And once we've done that, we will not have them sitting around in the traffic lights, living in danger of being overrun and killed by these trucks and whatnot. They will have places where they go and do, you know, that. And perhaps that can also expand to educate society as to what can be done going beyond to deal with the rest of the others. These guys that are throwing sticks in front of cars so that they can get a cent or something. That's the real capability. Some of those guys can easily become acrobats and outstanding achievers, and we can do it. So, the challenge for our experts in various fields that you are trained in is that we must start by making these people employable, or at least that percentage we require. Let's find a mechanism by which we satisfy ourselves that these people are employable first and foremost. So when the gaps appear, you don't say, no, but we don't have anybody. You can perhaps even identify them and go and get them and bring them into that. That is what I'd like to contribute to this discussion, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kota. Honorable Raputi.
Yeah, thank you very much for the presentation. The National School of Governing. And I think really it's so powerful. And this National School of Governance, I just wanted to check, is it in line with the performance management development of the employees, or any person can just go there and apply to do the courses there? Just wanted to check with the Diplomatic Academy, did you do the checklist? What the academy is offering and what you are not offering. No duplication in that case. And as the courses that you are doing, are they internationally inclined? And I'm of the view, really, the National School of Governance, that is a prerequisite of every public servant, must be able to have those kinds of capabilities, especially on issues of governance, because we lack.
we lack on issues of governance. And that is it. And when should a person really start applying to go to that National School of Governance? Because it's near customer care. Just near that would be the principle. It's along to our public servant. So National School of Governance, I think that should be a prerequisite of every public servant. From you know, the person who's answering the phone to undergo that to go to that school. Because people, they don't understand that even answering the phone is part of governance, the service that you provide to, you know, to our people. It's just a school that is there or is being attended by the directors, chief directors, to run away from responsibility. I'm sorry, but I'm just asking myself, because I just wanted to check if the junior people knows about this National School of Governance. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Honorable Lento, Rafuti, Honorable Kenneth, and next on the
right. Thank you, Deputy. Thank you for the presentation. My only one question, maybe, on this issue. As we know that there are so many challenges, only physical challenges with different ways and the disabled persons. Now, my question is that now that we are saying yes, they are very disadvantaged. But I just want to check if you have any statistics to check that there are lecturers or assistants or trained staff that can assist all of them on different ways. Because the reason I'm saying that if you want to expand, as Honorable Robert has just said, to expand to remove the barriers to access to the participation of the physical challenged people. Also, we have to take into consideration the statistics, maybe the percentage also that he's talking about. If we have got those people who are going to teach them on different spheres, for example, those who have got enough staff for sign languages and think about those things, sign languages or whatever. So sign languages, braille and whatever, so that we can be able that even if we still are expanding the percentage, if but at the same time, they are supposed to be taught in different ways, so to get them to the mainstream in a large scale. Just to check if you have got, you have explored that area. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you, Honourable Kenya. Any other means, Honourable Dudley, are you covered?
I'm covered.
All right, thank you. Back to the National School of Government.
Thank you very much. okay, let me just say, I wasn't aware of the Nauru opposition and of the diplomatic academy, but what we can do is, I can thank you how we've worked with the Durko Academy in the past, and then if you need a more official answer, we can ask our principal. I can take it, some of these things back to our principal, and then we can provide you a more official answer. So how we have actually worked, we basically train public servants. So that's been appointed under the Public Service Act. It can be semi-state departments or public departments, a local government, because of that one public sector that we're going towards, so that's that one question. Now, what we've been doing is we're saying we train in terms of the policies and the competencies and skills that public servants need to do their jobs. So we've got two categories. We've got our leadership programs, which basically train persons, we call it the Emerging Management Development Program, and then the development program for middle managers. So it's from salary level 1 to 5, and then 6 to 9, and you know, going up right through to parliamentarian training. So that's leadership. And in that leadership, we might have different modules. one on HRM, one on project management, specific things like that. But the three-day HRM module, for example, is only 3 days, and you cannot take a specific technical subject and make people an expert on 3 days. So they look at it from a management perspective and say that line has a responsibility with corporate services for certain HR issues or project management or finance or management. And then there's my side of the work, which then does the training more in depth and specializing, looking at the DPSA strategic frameworks, for example, on strategic HR planning, disability management, and all of that. We actually, the school is divided into 4 streams, what we call it, 4 practical areas of training. The one is on compulsory induction. The other one is on leadership, so it trains all the leadership issues. Then we've got what we call the management stream. That is where our corporate services support lies. That's human resource management and development and project management. Then there's a directorate for financial management and supply chain management training, and then we've got monitoring and evaluation, job evaluation, and organizational design. And then we've got a chief director called administration, and that's where issues of governance and ethics and anti-corruption occur. Now, in terms of the question that who can come to the training, basically, if a person is a public servant, or even if it's semi-government or local government, we can train in terms of our mandate. So the department can approach us, or we go to the department and we say that this is what you need to have in place. And we say to them, this is the issues we've identified in your department. We look at all of the general reports, we look at the impact results, and then we say this is what we need to have in place, and we offer our training. How it worked in the past is to say that sectorial training, like for example the Nursing Academy or the Diplomatic Academy or NIA in the past, they have specific core skills for that specialized type of jobs that those persons do. But they have come to us for the public service kinds of skills. So for example, in the Durko Academy of Foreign Affairs previously, we made a project of it where they would come to us for leadership and project management, for example, and then they would train specific skills that international relations staff needed to have. In terms of the percentage in the nation of persons with disability, in the white paper, they actually have a little bit of general data. They say in terms of social grants that were paid out to persons with disabilities, the system at 38 for 2015 shows that there's 1,100 and it's triple, it's 1,111,063 beneficiaries received disability grants. 127,139 children with disabilities received care dependency grants. 115,256 social grant beneficiaries access grants in aid. And the KwaZulu-Natal province has the highest access to care dependency grants of 28.7%, followed by Gauteng, which is 12.8%, Eastern Cape is 15.1%. KwaZulu province, KwaZulu-Natal also has the highest access to disability grants in terms of 25.5%. Followed by Eastern Cape of 16.5% and the Western Cape of 14%. KwaZulu-Natal also has the highest access to grants in aid, which is 54.7%, followed by Limpopo at 19.1% and the Eastern Cape at 14.4%. If you look at the types of disability, the South African Statistics 2011 census, there are 0.8% are unable to perform self-care functions, 0.2% experience difficulties with remembering and concentrating, 0.1% experience difficulty with hearing, 0.3% experience difficulties with walking, climbing stairs, 0.2% have difficulty with communication. The same 2011 census shows the following proportions of persons with disabilities who have some difficulties in terms of their general health and functioning: 9.4% remembering and concentrating, 3.3% hearing, 2.9% walking, climbing stairs, 2.6% self-care and 2.0% self-care, and then communication at 1.1%. So the statistics provide the following breakdown of persons with disabilities by race group. Indian Asian is 4.6%, colored is 4.2%, African is 4.0%, and white is 3.2%. So that was just an indication in the white paper. There's some more people, you know, in terms of the employment of persons with disabilities and other information. Okay. Employment of persons percentages in the universities and technical colleges, I'm not sure in terms of that figure, but we can try and make it through social development to find that information. We do have strategic partnerships at this stage with, and we are part of the disability, the national disability management machinery. So we have partnerships with Department of Higher Education and Training. We started off in small to start looking at core training issues, but this is not in a big way. But the idea that I have had and what I would like to do, and I'm not just saying this is not authorized for anything, this is just an idea. But I believe that persons with disabilities, the children, become adults with disabilities. And I'm not sure if our teachers and our principals know how to deal with a child with disabilities. So what I was thinking is to have principals and teachers go through a one-day or two-day workshop on dealing with disability issues and what it's about and what is barriers that they create through something like their attitude and things like that. So that's the idea that we've had. We're also part of the, UNDESA. They brought out a toolkit called disability issues on issues of disability and justice, disability and health, disability and safety and security. So we were part of writing that documentation, that courses, and now in Namibia there will be a training session in December. And once we've seen the final version, we will start integrating it into the training as well. So for example, when we train justice as a department, we can then customize it and build in that module on justice. And when we train health, of course, from the generic stuff they need to know, we can build that in.
Can I factor, because you're almost summarizing, I factor in my comments and questions so that you just close it up just like that? You didn't have pages, no?
Sorry,
Jay,
it's
in what looks like page?
If you take background, the first one on background, that's
great. And proposed additions to bill.
Okay, that's slide 3.
Okay. Now, line number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, number 9. You say this directive may be included in codes to be called the Foreign Service Administration Manual in the Code of Conduct for the Foreign Service, or any other code that may be adopted.
Yeah.
Now, why are you using the word may instead of must? Because I would have thought that if you want the Foreign Service in terms of employment of persons and in terms of friendliness, friendliness by the building itself, you would have said must. And then in the next slide, which is building and training, now I don't understand what you are saying here, because you are saying new addition, which is capacity building and training. But then, the section that you simply have picked up, section 6,
You are talking about what the department is responsible for, which is A, providing training or constant training to be provided to employees and members of the Forest Service in a format or means that will enable persons with disabilities to readily access learning. Is this what the Diplomatic Academy is already responsible for, or is a new addition? It doesn't sound like a new addition, but what they are currently responsible for. Now, this formulation, just the last one, the persons with disabilities to readily access learning. Now, I thought you were going to say to access buildings in the mission, because you are improving the deal on foreign service, and you are saying that the buildings in the foreign mission must be user friendly to persons with disability. And I'm not sure if you have or have not been able to establish through a circular about the extent of the friendliness of user friendliness of these buildings to people with disabilities, different disabilities, in the national domain and in the foreign domain, or you are just making a proposal, and whether you are able to make inspections. Now, sometimes stories are nice, and we run out of the time. You know, it is interesting to note how far we've come. If you look at my history, I was born and bred in the farm. Most of, including my elder brother, most of my cousins and others were taken out of school to go and work in the farm as soon as because they were able-bodied. Now, I was the only one, at least from that family, who was told that, you see, you can't work in the farm. You can't work in the contracts. You can't do good physical work. You must go to school because actually you are disabled. And I was born normal, whatever it means to be normal, like you. Then I got injured when I was in standard, when I was eight, between five and a half to six. Now, with hindsight, I can say, but having grown in that environment, if I didn't get injured, I would not have gone to school. Well, they were taking them out. It was just normal. It was home cool, I'm for 7th plaza. And of course, I also got the same benefit from Parliament. The ANC made a policy for disabled persons. Now, it had to tick in the list. How many people are going to Parliament? So many. How many are women? So many. How many from the regions, the regional representation? So many. Then how many are disabled? For a long time, they were ticking next to my name. And they didn't hand for any other person. Since 1999, every disabled person won. Yeah, probably. And therefore, that means the only reason I went to school is disability. The only reason I went MP is disability. What if I didn't get disabled? But I was just saying how far we've come. When I registered at the University of Limpopo, all the buildings were not user-friendly to disabled persons. Those
who were using wheelchair. It was after a strike by the students that these things must be done, that it was done. Of course, we did have a mandate in it. But the ramps, they were constructed only last year, 1982. There was another strike for pregnant women not to be expelled because they argued that it doesn't affect their intelligence. I remember one who was pregnant and married. Said, no, I'm married, I must proceed with my family and I must also learn. And then besides that, I can't be here. So, some of these things that have, I'm saying, this shows how far we've come. In the USA, President Dendey and myself can't be president because we're short. The Americans don't want a... To the extent possible, their president must be taller than any other. And of course, Norm Carver, you know, you must be trim and you know, your skin just Bush and Obama. Well, Trump seems to be a bit of an exception, but he's tall, anyway. Yeah, no, you don't have to answer on this one. I'm just going to yeah, okay. You can close it off and then we can then...
Thank you, Chair. I take the point in section 96 of my... I think we should exchange that word and give it some peace. In terms of us inspecting the actual physical site, no, that wasn't... but there are regulations and public works have regulations on how buildings should look and how they should be covered, so you know, they should be built that specification, and people wanting to rent and lease to just check against those specifications. The part about the access, all the buildings to be accessed in section 9, I can reword this section a little bit. I tried to bring it in the background, I suppose, where I said South African mission, but I think I will reword this paragraph so that it talks to access and universal design. And then the service administration, the code of conduct, what I mean by that is that it must just be inculcated and it's integrated into those issues. The access to learning part is not adding a whole new section, Chair. It is basically taking an existing section, which means that the Diplomatic Academy is already providing training or causing training to be provided. Now, causing training to be provided could mean that they can appoint another trainer provider to do that. What we wanted to say basically there is that the learning material and the way that information should be accessed by persons with disabilities should be in a format that person with a disability can access it. So, for example, if you have a blind student, then material can be printed in Braille, or just just slightly sight problems, it can be a bigger font or things like that. So that's what it actually means by that. So I can also reword that part. It's just how the word white paper is writing is very really big and broad. We can just make it more specific.
Including the topic, on
yes.
The first page, response to foreign affairs, dear. It's foreign affairs. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. 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 Sorry about that. Proceed. Proceed, Mrs. McNeil, if you still have. Or you were closing off.
Yes, I think so. I think I could address the question.
Thank you very much. I think that you know,
advised that lunch would be served at 12:30. And the meeting is now coming to a close prematurely at breakfast 12. Members and officials are invited to lunch at half past 12. Hello, Tatele.
Chairperson, I'm looking at Kiyama, the act itself. I think it's one of the best pieces of legislation you can come across here. But there's one clause which I'm having an issue with. It's clause 21, offensive and penalties. I read that thing initially, they didn't come back. They are not escaping now. I'm still bringing it back. Under section 21, it shows that if an accounting officer willfully does not comply with this thing, with this act, he must be prosecuted and go to jail or must be fined. I spoke about dilapidated buildings here. Was any accounting officer ever prosecuted because of Clause 21 of this act? Ever, only one, since 2007.
How about that?
The answer is no. But the intention is there. I think the operative word, without being, we don't want to say we are not doing what we're supposed to do and so forth. But what we're basically saying is that the act is very strict and it's got tools. And the operative word there is willfully. Willfully. It says if willfully. So if they do that, they will be subjected. So we did not forget that, you know. Hence, we are saying that the Foreign Services Bill, through you, Chairperson, has got to ensure that the spirit in which the Giyama has been written with is inculcated into the bill, is included there, because what it shows, intent, that we do want to make a difference and ensure that state immovable assets are safeguarded. I think that's just, it should actually, it's a good point actually that should say the reason why we are saying this piece of act is a good one, that, you know, the Foreign Services Bill must also ensure that, you know, it includes the spirit of
I think you should advise your minister, maybe the DGC and then ultimately the minister to do something about this building in Namibia and Brasilia. Because it has been raised last week. Was it last week before last week? When the minister was here. When Minister Nkwane Mushabane was here about these buildings. The person who asked the question from the committee said, why do you prefer leasing departments, leasing buildings, and spending this much in such countries, in that one, that one, that one. Then there are buildings in Brazil, in Bonn, Namibia. But these buildings are lying far away, but then we are leasing, and leasing is expensive. Why do we do that? Why are they not being refurbished? And the minister said, it's another department which must do that. But you see, it's very ridiculous. Because you've got South African buildings, and then decide you are leaving. I think public works can be requested to attend to them, these buildings for them. Yeah, something like that. Because otherwise, the suspicion from the committee is that we are living in the buildings of friends. They are not in there. So, in other implications. Yeah, with that, honorable members and ladies and gentlemen, once again, let's thank you for attending our meeting with the two departments, and thank the departments for their worthy presentations and their areas of support and areas of objections and the reasons thereof. Yeah. All of this will contribute to
in the refinement of the beer. And with that, I'm told that lunch is being served now.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, we are all invited to lunch. The meeting is adjourned.
When did you move over?
From DCS.
He was at DCS. I used to drive past him in the morning.
No, I
we look different.
I don't see you anymore.
How are you, sir?
Good man, and you?
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Oh, okay.
Okay, cool.
Yes, then they'll start, then they'll want to say one thing, then they'll literally, and then,
happening to the blockade?
We are fighting. We are fighting, yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you had this time with the
Thank you.
Thank you.